This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief at the New Books Network, and just a warning about the following interview. We had a bad phone connection, and so the audio is a little bit rough. But in any case, I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is.
Good day, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, hosted by Dhara Anjaria out of Bombay, India. The setting for what was perhaps the last important shake-up of colonial governance, the Government of India Act 1935. Our guest today is Professor Andrew Muldoon of the Metropolitan State College of Denver, Colorado, and he's going to be talking to us about his new book, which is all about the Government of India Act 1935. It's an act whose legacy endures yet. Around two-thirds of the constitution of modern India is based upon its provisions, and Andrew is going to be telling us about the people who were involved in it, not only directly in the drafting of the act, or in that they would be under its purview, but also about the people for whom the act ended up challenging their ideas of empire and Britain's place in the world. Over to Andrew.
Thank you for doing this for the New Books Network. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Pleasure. Could you just, you know, start off by telling our listeners something about yourself and your academic career to date?
Sure. Well, I'm Andrew Muldoon, and I currently teach at Metropolitan State University in Denver, Colorado. And my major academic area of research is late imperial, or you might say sort of late colonial South Asia, particularly the period of the 1920s, 30s, and 1940s. My background, briefly, is I have a bachelor's degree from Tufts University, a master's degree from Cambridge University, and my PhD from Washington University in St. Louis.
Wow, that's interesting. That would give anybody a complex. What kind of research do you normally do, and how did you come to the writing of this book?
Well, I initially came to the writing of this book. My initial interest was in Anglo-Irish relations, but then I was very interested in parallels between sort of Anglo-Irish and Anglo-Indian relations, especially as I encountered work about the ways in which British colonial officials themselves attempted to compare Irish and Indian situations from the early 20th century, especially regarding Bengal. I intended originally to write something that was a very high political history, but as I researched, this book came together really in the archives. It came together as I researched and became aware of the various sort of cultural influences, structural problems of information gathering that were there within the British colonial state, and it became a combination of a political history and also an investigation of how you might say political intelligence worked in late colonial India. And it was something that did evolve. The more I read the sources, the more I was very much interested in not just how people made decisions about colonial policy for India, but also the context, the framework, the ideas that they had in their minds as they made these decisions.
So could you just tell us something about the book in a nutshell, summarize it?
Sure. Well, it's an attempt to look at the construction of the 1935 India Act, which was sort of the penultimate British throw of the dice in an attempt to keep control of India by ceding provincial self-government and then some form of federal centralized government in which the British would still hold really the key areas of power. My interest was originally how Conservative Party politicians in Britain persuaded a very dubious party membership to back this. And what I discovered, in essence, was that it was politicians informed by colonial officials and others in the, you might say, colonial public, or what they would call in Britain the Indian public, who helped shape what sort of concessions would be made to Indian nationalism. And so my book is an investigation of political decision-making that led up to the 1935 India Act, and quite simply, what it was that led politicians, policymakers, colonial administrators to believe that, in fact, this was a solution to the problem of Indian nationalism, and that this would ensure the sort of stability of, or at least some sort of colonial presence in South Asia for the foreseeable future.
But specifically the Conservative Party, what was its relationship with the India Act as such? I mean, why would you choose to focus on that and maybe not some other British political views?
Well, two reasons. First, they were the ones simply in power during this period, between when the sort of formative decisions were made, between 1924 and 29, and then as really the dominant partner in the national government, the coalition government, from late 1931 onwards. And secondly, because they were the one political party out of the three major ones, Labour, Liberal, and Conservative, they were the ones for whom India and, in a larger sense, empire still loomed largest. Those ideas loomed largest in their identity, in their construction of themselves as a political party, what they stood for. And it was, in some senses, only the Conservative Party, in some sense, which felt it could take steps on India because it claimed sort of an authority over colonial knowledge and over, you might say, sort of the trusteeship of colonial rule. So that's why I focus on the Conservatives. Firstly, they were the ones making the policy, and secondly, they were the ones for whom this policy and the future of British colonial presence in South Asia, they were the ones for whom it mattered the most.
I think it still matters because I think they still have the stance that, they share maybe Indian values and things. But to go back to your earlier comment, you mentioned that it was a task for the Conservative Party leadership, to actually convince, most of the followers, about the need to implement the act. So the point is, where was the leadership informed from, and why were their views divergent from those of the party rank and file?
Well, this was one of the things that became very interesting, was that the leadership, there became sort of a struggle over who actually knew what India was. Oftentimes, now this was a struggle which was fought out within a very sort of specific and limited context. That is, with those who opposed further concessions to India and those who supported them arguing within a very narrow frame of reference, which still treated South Asians as politically immature, lacking in sort of, as they called it, moral character or fiber to make political decisions, that Indian politics was entirely based on patronage, that Indian politics was both divided by religion and divided even by caste and other sort of interest group divisions. So the decision was made that to do something that would attempt to sort of buy off Indian nationalism, with the argument at least made privately among those who were in charge of forming colonial policy, the argument was made that you could do this without risking, or at least they thought, without risking anything damaging to colonial rule, because Indians, in some senses, couldn't take political responsibility. And the information that informed that view tended to come from a very small group, many of whom had ties to the Conservative Party, whether it was viceroys, whether it was appointed governors in provinces like Bombay and in Bengal or in Madras. There was a very limited flow of information, and even the information that came from the supposed sources on the ground, that is, British district officials, police officials, sort of long-standing administrative types within the Indian civil service, they tended to basically work in a very sort of narrow context in which certain ideas sort of became almost sort of self-sustaining, and also in which there was very limited, not limited necessarily, but there was not full access to perhaps the realities of Indian nationalist politics.
When you mentioned the realities of Indian nationalist politics, do you mean to say that there was actually a strong push, you know, from the native side, from the Indian side, to actually, you know, draft this act in what would be, you know, seen as some sort of stepping stone to full autonomy? I mean,
well, this is one of the things. Yes, I mean, there were. It's part of my book deals with those who were not members of the Congress Party, not with Nehru, Gandhi, and others, but in particular were members of a very small group, this sort of Indian liberal group, in particular a lawyer named Tej Bahadur Sapru, who was a constitutional lawyer, an advocate, and someone who sort of reappears throughout the 20s and 30s, and even well into the 1940s as a mediator, a publicist, someone trying to sort of forge an agreement. And I think that he saw this proposal for a federal India as exactly that, as a stepping stone, something that once begun would inevitably move towards greater and greater self-government. And one of the things that's interesting is that he was, because he was not engaged in civil disobedience, because he was not a member of the Congress, he occupied this sort of middle ground, and he was, my argument is, and from my work in his papers and what he wrote and what he sort of commented on to other liberals, was that he saw himself as uniquely positioned to push the British towards constitutional reform, sort of from within. And I think that you can understand his position in particular in that he and another lawyer, a Mumbai lawyer named Jayakar, were sort of the go-betweens between the colonial administration and Gandhi and Nehru, particularly Gandhi. When Gandhi was imprisoned, when Gandhi was fasting, Sapru and Jayakar were the ones who were sort of charged with going back and forth. And my argument is that Sapru realized that this gave him an enormous amount of influence, and that he could use this influence to, in some sense, shape British perceptions of what would result. And he believed that by keeping the British on the path to constitutional reform, by getting things actually passed through Parliament and written down, that you would create this sort of momentum, almost this sort of, you know, inevitability about constitutional reform. He differed with Gandhi on many things, especially tactics. But he wrote to Gandhi and expressed to Gandhi several times that, you know, he held the same long-term vision for India, or at least for India politically, that Gandhi did.
So in the sense, it was very clear that ultimately the long-term vision, you know, did not include the British.
Well, I think for Sapru, yes, the long-term vision ultimately did not include the British, but it did include self-government, and not the sort of, I mean, I think Sapru would have been absolutely fine with a British governor general standing in, sort of as, you know, Mountbatten eventually wound up, but not something like, I mean, he did not see the 1935 Act as a final stage. He saw that as part of a progression, simply because it continued to reserve to the viceroy an enormous number of powers. It's interesting that Sapru was very much a proponent of this federal plan, and then, of course, probably about 13, 14 years later, Sapru was one of the people influential in sort of helping to shape the Indian Constitution, which relied very much upon this idea of a federal India and the balance of how the balance of powers would be sort of distributed between the federal center and the states.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about federation. I mean, that is kind of interesting because it did give a lot of room for, you know, integrating what might perhaps have been reluctant entities. I mean, especially the princes, you mentioned the support of the federation. So could you just elaborate a bit more on, you know, the federal provisions of the India Act?
Sure. The federal provision was designed by the British to, in essence, serve as almost sort of an insurance policy against the Congress Party. It really was aimed against the Congress Party. the idea was that Indian provinces, provincial legislatures, would have autonomy, and with provincial governors enjoying a few special powers that might be employed in times of emergency, but other than that, provincial autonomy. But then these provinces would indirectly elect representatives to a federal assembly, but the provincial representatives would only be part of that, and that there would also be a significant block of representatives from the Indian princely states who would not be elected but would be nominated by these various rulers, with the idea being that through these nominees plus a significant number of reserved seats especially reserved for Muslims, in the central legislature, that there would be erected a block, and that no matter how well a party like Congress did in the provinces, sort of structurally and institutionally, they would not be able to function as a central or in a central legislature. That was the idea. The idea was behind the initial plan was that Congress wouldn't even succeed in the provinces. I mean, there was a great raft of predictions in 1936 and 1937 in a place like Madras that what was called the Justice Party in Madras would sweep the elections in the Congress, and the Justice Party was absolutely decimated in the elections. Congress took the Madras Legislative Assembly quite easily and left British colonial officials wondering what exactly had happened, because part of their idea was that Congress wouldn't win necessarily easy majorities anywhere. And then once they did, that meant that it was time to rethink just how effective even the central federation would be.
But the Congress was anyway not very happy with the whole federal idea, I think. I mean, I would assume that they approached it with a certain reluctance, because obviously these provisions were, again, like, not very well received by, let's say, Gandhi or Nehru. And
I was just going to say that, I mean, it took some convincing in 1936 for both, especially for Nehru, to participate in the provincial elections of 1937. He initially wasn't on board with them. He needed to be convinced by others in the sort of inner circle of Congress that there existed the infrastructure and there existed the possibility of creating something national out of these provincial elections, which is what they did, because they then came up with the All India Coordinating Committee, the sort of establishing a framework for making Congress now truly a national party. And I think Nehru needed some convincing of that, certainly. I think he initially thought it was, participating in something that was kind of a sham. But once he realized that this gave him, or that this would give the party a sense of legitimacy, perhaps, by claiming victories in multiple provinces, and something that the British weren't counting on. The British thought everything will be localized and there will be no sort of difficulties with this at all.
In that case, would you say that it was a Congress victory, despite the federal structure in the 1930s election, that prompted them to include this feature when the main constitution was drafted? I mean, what kind of a role did, let's say, people like Saprew and Jaikar have in the drafting of the main constitution? Because federalism is obviously one of the most important carryover, elements.
Sure. Yep. Well, I think that, I mean, someone like Saprew, who died either, I believe, in 1950, but or maybe 51, but he helped to draft at least sections of the constitution. As far as I know, very influential, and he was a sort of, by the late 1940s, he was one of these sort of Indian wise men, you might say. I mean, among other things, he acted for the defense in the INA trials in November 1945 in Delhi with Nehru and others, but just sort of he was there and was very influential in sort of shaping people's understandings of how a federal constitution would work. In terms of which sections of the federation or the federal system that emerged out of the constitution he particularly embraced, I'm not sure. But I do know that he believed in the federal idea as a sort of workable model. And I think also for someone like Nehru, at least to some extent that part of the attraction or part of the rationale behind some of the decisions he made in the summer of 1947, spring summer of 1947, did deal with the fact that there was, in essence, this blueprint in existence for, you know, not a perfect blueprint by any stretch, but a blueprint for creating a federal state, and that the longer decisions were delayed, and the more negotiating you'd have to do, the more difficult this project would be. But at least I think, in some senses, Nehru by 1947 appreciated what the federal government meant, and in particular what it would mean for the future of Congress in terms of how a strong central government would really sort of benefit a political party which controlled that same central government.
Sorry to keep on harping about federalism,
sure.
But I was just wondering what was the attitude of, you know, the governors of Bombay and Madras presidency? I mean, you know, this whole idea that these presidencies are historically, you know, distinct from, let's say, Bengal or the rest of India. So was there some kind of encouragement from the setups of these two provinces, you know, to actually incorporate the federal feature because they would themselves have more autonomy that way?
You mean the governors themselves?
Yeah, the governors and obviously the cadres, you know, the people, the food.
Well, I think that there was some hesitation among members of the Indian Civil Service. There were some hesitation among some of these governors. But, one of the things about these governors is that many of them were political appointees not drawn out of the ICS, but drawn out of the sort of the world of Conservative Party politics. And when you look at the governors Brabourne in Bombay and John Anderson in Bengal, just to name two, you have two people who are largely plucked out of sort of Conservative politics. We'll go back, well, in the case of Anderson, we'll go back to Conservative politics in the 1940s, and they toe the party line. And the other thing is that within the Indian civil service itself, there was not nearly the opposition to this plan that opponents of the plan back in Britain hoped for. That is, the Indian civil service by the late 1930s was already engaged in the process of what was called Indianization, expansion of the numbers of South Asians working in the Indian civil service. There was a sense that especially the younger generation in the Indian civil service, that this was not a permanent posting, thought that this was not something where they were going to make their career. And so there was not, the real opposition came from people who were former members of the Indian Civil Service, who had retired to Britain 10, 15 years previously. So I think that in the provinces, because you have governors appointed through a political process based in Britain, and you have a civil service which is in some senses in flux, that there was not a lot of dramatic opposition. There were still plenty of predictions, as we could see in Madras, with predictions by the governor there and by other members of the ICS as to what was going to happen in the election there. There were still predictions. But many of these governors felt, at least I think, some obligation, especially the governors in the sort of prize provinces like Bengal and Bombay, felt some sort of obligation to stick with the political line that was coming from London.
Moving away from federalism now, now when you're talking about the India Act, I mean, at least in modern India, I mean, it's always positioned as a sort of, you know, on a continuum, let's say, so you have the 1909 reforms, the 1919 reforms in the Government of India Act, and then the Independence Act. So, I mean, do you think that actually makes sense, or is it just, you know, post-independence construct?
Well, I think it makes some sense in the fact that sort of from 1947 on, as we discussed, you know, so much of the framework laid out in the India Act is incorporated into the government of the Republic of India. So I think it's influential that way. I think that the 1935 Act represents, in some senses, the final stage of a process which begins even in the 1890s with an attempt to appoint local appoint representatives to local councils, but to reserve seats when doing it, and to, in essence, begin to try and create blocs within the Indian political scene. I think 1935 represents sort of the end of it, because the framers of the 1935 Act came up so swiftly against, or experienced so quickly, you might say, sort of the failure of their, if not the failure of their plan, at least a significant challenge to it, because the provincial elections of 1937 so went against what had been predicted. And again, with the notion that Congress was going to be governing in, you know, either by themselves or in coalition, in I think eight different provinces after 1937, absolutely no one had anticipated that, and it changed the dynamics greatly. That's why I sort of say that 1935, the subtitle of my book is that the 1935 India Act is the last act of the Raj. In some senses, you know. It's a pun, but in other senses, it is the last act of people imbued with a certain mindset about how they believe Indian politics works and Indian society works. And 1937 demonstrates, to at least some degree, that their anticipations or their expectations are not entirely well-founded.
So, could you just tell us something more about who were these people who drafted the act and what were the expectations? You know, where did they come from?
Sure. Well, the drafting of the act was largely done in, there are two ways. It was done through the India office back in London, but also with consultation with various groups. There were a series of what were called roundtable conferences where various politicians from South Asia representing a variety of groups. There were three different roundtable conferences. You had the princes, you had people like Sapru, you had representatives of the Muslim League like Muhammad Ali Jinnah, you had representatives of various caste organizations, especially untouchables with B.R. Ambedkar present there. And you also had sort of this whole raft of civil servants who spent their lives drafting sort of legislation for India. And the plan was put together. One of the things that happened was that in essence, certain figures emerged as influential in, if not writing specific aspects of it, sort of providing advice and providing a sort of reassurance that this kind of approach would work, that this includes people like Sapru. It includes the Viceroy from 1926 to 31, Lord Irwin. And it also includes a man named Malcolm Haley, who was a long-serving member of the Indian Civil Service, had risen to become governor of the UP by the mid-1930s, who was treated as this, you know, sort of almost the sort of, you know, a walking reference as to what would work in India and what wouldn't. And Haley himself understood that, you know, he was really sort of if people needed something absolutely sort of figured out, they'd say, well, ask Malcolm Haley. And the idea that he sort of preserved the institutional memory of the Raj as well as a sense of how politics in South Asia worked. So over time, there's a series of conferences and a series of proposals put forth for how federation will work. There is an enormous discussion about whether any mention of the word dominion will occur in the framing of the Constitution, or in the framing of this act, and it is decided that it will not, much to the dismay even of people like Sapru, that mentioning dominion after 1931 conjured up ideas of basically self-rule. And there's some concern to insert various safeguards to ensure that you can't have a situation parallel with that in Ireland, where the Irish Free State in the 1930s began to basically undo its relationship with London. So that there's a coming together, there are various negotiations made, there are decisions made about what the franchise will be, who will vote, whether there will be reserved seats and separate electorates. In particular, you have in 1932 what's called the Communal Award, which is going to sort of frame how various groups will vote, which provides a separate electorate for Ambedkar and the Untouchables, but which is opposed by Gandhi. And Gandhi himself goes on a fast in protest, leaving Ambedkar, the colonial government, and even some allies of Gandhi wondering as to what is going to happen. So it's a drawn-out process also, because at every stage of these of this framing, the Conservative Party leadership needs to bring it back to its party and gain approval, or at least fend off any opposition. And they're very useful at that, because they continually say, well, nothing is actually final and we can't discuss it. Well, it's, you know, still in draft form. And they use, you know, the word sub judice an enormous amount to sort of say, well, it's still under consideration, therefore we'll just have to pass on putting it to a vote until the absolute last moment, in which they can basically structure a vote so that the Conservative Party approves, the party membership approves of what they're doing.
So did the party membership approve finally? What was the reaction?
They did approve, and I think that what they demonstrate is the way in which the Conservative Party in the 20th century really is very good at managing its membership. And that it is, it's not necessarily that the party is such a hierarchical and deferential organization, but that the conservatives were very good, you might say, professional politicians, and they were very good at framing the debate in certain ways, and especially in making a vote on Indian policy into, or giving it a larger meaning, that a vote on this was actually a vote on the leadership of someone like Stanley Baldwin, and that it was, in essence, sort of challenging the conservatives and saying, just how much does India matter to you that you will oppose this plan? And saying, does it matter enough to potentially break apart this party and, heaven forbid, bring back Labour? And they held out that sort of specter of a resurgent Labour Party in 1934, 1935, as sort of a way of keeping conservatives in line. It wasn't necessarily that conservatives were naturally deferential, but they had, in the leadership, even people like Neville Chamberlain, who, you know, whatever he became as a diplomat or as a sort of a foreign policy man, he was very well attuned to how the party worked internally, and sort of what buttons you could push and how you could sort of turn party opinion by making questions not about policy, but about, in some senses, leadership and legitimacy and even personality.
So, just to get this right, the choice was between getting Labour back into power or, you know, losing India, in the sense that...
Well, the choice that was presented to the Conservative Party members was, it had several elements to it. The first, it said, this is the policy of the leadership. If you don't like it and you vote against it, you will in essence be causing a leadership contest and a leadership crisis, which, as it turns out, most conservatives wanted to avoid in 1934 and 1935. Secondly, they also argued that if you did this, if you voted against this policy, you would be losing India. They argued that this was a way of holding on to India, of, you know, sort of giving India some greater aspects of political self-rule, but also keeping India within the empire, keeping certain British interests safeguarded there. And so it was sort of, not necessarily a calling the bluff of the party, but it was this sort of two-pronged message which said, do you want to keep India, and do you want to have our party fall apart and allow Labour to come back in? And at a time, 1934, 1935, in which Labour was rebuilding a little bit after the collapse of 1931, and especially in local elections, the Labour Party was beginning to gain back some ground. There, your average conservative party member, member of the conference who voted at the national union meetings, they didn't want to take any chances. And one of my arguments in the book is that for all the conservative party's devotion to the idea of empire, ultimately, when it came down to it, they were willing to put aside concerns about sort of future of empire when or if it might endanger conservative party rule. And so they were willing to have at least a little bit of ideological flexibility.
Yeah, that would explain it, because I mean, if you have the term something like keeping India within the empire, that's very ambiguous, it's not very well defined, so it could mean anything. It's probably very different from the conservative position of maybe cousins.
So, exactly.
Yeah. So anyway,
well, I was going to say also that they also... Oh, sorry. I was just going to mention briefly that another thing that was raised to scare conservatives was the sense that if we don't do it now, if we don't make these concessions now, we're going to run the risk of another Ireland. And there was much back and forth about whether Gandhi was the equivalent of Éamon de Valera in Ireland, or whether, you know, sort of de Valera was the Irish Gandhi or something like that. So all of these things were trotted out in an effort to keep conservative opinion, in one sense, sort of, you know, on one side, and it worked.
So you mentioned something about institutional memory of the Raj, and that's what the bureaucrats drafting it wanted to keep alive, you know, by drafting the act, and I would assume that was very much the goal of the party as well, you know, some sort of continuing influence, maybe?
Certainly a continuing influence, and they, I mean, the actual drafting of the act was, I mean, in some senses, it was an exercise in public relations with having consultations and roundtable conference meetings. But it was, I mean, it was drafted very carefully with one eye towards what was perceived to be sort of the political situation in India, but with another eye towards what was seen as sort of, you know, the ultimate sort of, or what was seen as, you know, ultimately permissible within the Conservative Party. There were some who wanted to say that this act included or forecast a future Indian dominion. But that was not in the final version, because those who ran the Conservative Party said, you know, we can keep people on side with, as you say, an ambiguous phrase, keeping India within the empire. But once you start trotting out things like dominion, especially after what's happened in Ireland over the previous decade, that's not going to fly.
No, not really. And in fact, I was wondering about the act itself. I mean, 1935, and it's 12 years to, you know, transfer power. So to what extent was the act actually implemented? Because you had the war and the ministries resigned, the Congress ministries. So, I mean, how was it implemented in full form?
Well, it was never really implemented in full form. I mean, you get the provincial elections, and then you have a lot of back and forth about when the next step will be taken. And the war intervenes, as you said. Congress resigns the ministries in 1939. At the end of the war, there are elections, but it's elections, if I remember my sequence correctly here, it's elections to an assembly that will then, in some senses, frame a new constitution. That is, that even the 1935 Act is no longer really operable. You had, during the war, various proposals, the famous Scripps Mission of 1942, which held out the idea that, you know, India would become a dominion at the end of the war. That immediately changed the framework, because by admitting that that was now possible, that changed what the 1935 Act meant, because the 1935 Act had scrupulously avoided any mentioning of the word dominion. So, I mean, the elections that are called in 1945 are very much sort of based on the structure of the 1935 Act. The elections called in 1946. What you get, of course, is a much different distribution of the vote than existed in 1937, especially with, you know, the Muslim League increasing its share of the vote, especially its share of the Muslim vote, enormously. And so the 1935 Act, I think, probably provides the framework for those elections. But after that, it was then a sense of how is this situation going to be negotiated, rather than will this assembly or will an assembly meet to decide it, or is this something which party leaders are going to have to decide?
I'm just wondering whether the provisions of the wording of the act ever, you know, formally suspended. I mean, like when you have a situation where the state government or provincial government cannot really work, something akin to the emergency provisions in the modern constitution,
sure.
Like the Viceroy had certain overriding powers, so were these ever exercised during the law?
Well, that's tough to say. I mean, because the ministries kept going. They were, you know, because Congress, the Congress members of the legislatures all resigned, or the Congress ministries, I should say, all resigned. But in essence, the governors in the various provinces asked other parties, like, for example, the Muslim League, to put together governments which could function and which would continue. And once you had, by late 42, early 1943, once you have the mass arrest of so many Congress politicians and activists and, you know, members of these legislative assemblies, once you have that, you have, in essence, a system which keeps working, albeit in enormously restricted form. So it's not necessarily, I think, that emergency powers were declared. You might say that the biggest sort of demonstration of, if not an emergency power, a reserve power, was the Viceroy's declaration of war in September 1939 without consultation with any of the provincial ministers at all. And on the assumption that, well, foreign policy was still within the purview of the Viceroy. I think that's probably the biggest exercise of sort of unilateral power within this constitutional framework during the war.
Well, I think they were pretty much entitled to, you know, exercise a unilateral power. I mean, it might not have been palatable, but it was perfectly legal, I guess.
There was nothing, it wasn't this...
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, it wasn't that there was a question of the... Well, there wasn't a question of the legality, I think, or the constitutionality of the Viceroy's announcement in 1939. It was more the politics of it and the sort of the way in which it either didn't actually represent consultation, or there was not even an effort to sort of create an illusion of consultation with provincial ministries or with the Congress Party itself.
Okay, so obviously the Constitution was based on the Act, but I would assume that in the drafting of the Constitution it was mainly, you know, the largely Indian Constituent Assembly. So in the light of that, what are the major differences between, well, the Constitution and the Act? I mean, in terms of provisions of governance, you know, not obviously in the political difference.
You mean what are sort of the most substantive differences?
Yeah, substantive
constitutionally?
Differences. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think, well, in some senses, there is... actually, a stronger center, you might say, that emerges after 1950 in the Republic's Constitution. That is that one of the things about the 1935 Act was that it really did insist upon an enormous amount of provincial autonomy. The idea being that it would get Indians focused on sort of local politics or regional politics rather than national politics. Whereas, at least from my understanding of sort of Indian constitutional law or sort of Indian constitutional proceedings, I think that in some senses there is a greater degree of centralization, especially in areas like, for example, economic planning, I think, than existed under the 1935 Act. I mean, the 1935 Act was not framed by someone like Nehru, who believed that there ought to be, you know, sort of a not only a central government for political purposes, but also for planning purposes. So that is that, you know, the there was going to still be an Indian Reserve Bank, and there was still going to be sort of some centralized monetary policy and fiscal policy, but not the direction of even, you might say, sort of provincial or local economies, that would be written into the sort of structure of the Constitution or the structure of the Indian state, you might say, after 1950.
Interesting, and I actually attended Lawrence for the research. So, would you be continuing with this line, or like, what is your future research delving into?
Well, actually, my future is, I've gone in sort of a different direction, at least a little bit. I'm dealing with two things now that are kind of interrelated. One is actually the experiences of British and American and other imperial forces in India during the Second World War, and sort of looking in particular at their interactions with colonial society, and especially sort of the ways in which people who come from, you know, come out from Britain, come from the United States, come from sort of very, you might say, sort of non-colonial backgrounds, how they interact with colonial society. And also because the war in South Asia is, in Southeast Asia, contains all sorts of sort of strange sort of elements and contradictions. For example, the way in which the Americans continue to insist upon very strict segregation of the races in Calcutta for their own troops and for their own troops on leave and things like that, which sort of actually casts the colonial state in a slightly better light than the American administration. Attached to that is my other concern, which is about refugees in South Asia between 1939 and 1945. That is, not sort of refugees within South Asia, that is, people moving back and forth within South Asia, but people who were sort of collected in South Asia during the war, and then were in some cases almost sort of stateless at the end of the war. I've done some work on and presented some research at conferences on, in particular, the situation that you had about 5,000 Polish, largely women and children, in and near Bombay at the end of the war, who were the families of soldiers who had been freed from Stalin's gulag to go fight once Hitler invaded in 1941. And that's what I'm sort of interested in. It's the ways in which various refugee populations emerge in South Asia during the war, and then where they go afterwards, because there is a lot of sort of political maneuvering about people like these Poles, in the sense that, Britain doesn't want to take them, the Americans don't want to take them, the Poles adamantly refuse to go back to the Soviet Union, or to their homes, which were in Poland, but which are now in the Soviet Union. And it's a very sort of interesting moment, and I think very evocative of the position Britain finds itself in at the end of the war, in which it finds itself being faced with living up to pledges and living up to sort of promises that it might have made during the war, but now actually needs to sort of pay off. So that's my sort of two interrelated interests now. I've sort of shifted gears a little bit in the sense of moving away from sort of the political history and moving much more towards sort of, you might say, sort of the social history and the, I don't know if you'd call it sort of, not necessarily the cultural history, but the sort of the social, the economic, the wartime history of South Asia. So I'm very interested to see. I know that you were at Royal Holloway, and I know that Yasmin Khan is coming out with a book on wartime South Asia sometime next year. So I've had one email correspondence with her just briefly about that. So I'm very interested to see what she's going to come up with as well.
Oh, yeah, me too. I mean, I wasn't aware of her latest research, but I'll definitely be keeping a track of that. There was just one comment that I wanted to make. I mean, we've already taken up a lot of your time, but
sure.
One last one. You got this 1935 Act, and obviously it was heavily influenced by, you know, the wartime atmosphere. I mean, whether voluntarily or otherwise. But then you got the earlier reforms, let's say 1909, and then the 1919 reforms. There weren't really like, you know, formulated in response to the situation that arose, like, during the First World War. I mean, is that a correct assumption?
That these were not necessarily sort of precursors to the 1935 Act? I'm not exactly sure.
No, in the sense that when you had the reforms in, let's say, 1909, and then you had the war, and obviously you had a political situation that arose because of the war, and that didn't really affect the formulating of the 1919 reforms very much. I mean, not just the war and the situation created by it, but whereas you got the 1935 Act, and then you got the war, then you got the transfer of power, which was obviously, you know, hastened because of the war, and that actually kind of, well, it's pretty much was the end of the 1935 Act. So would you say that the Second World War, you know, in a way affected colonial policy, you know, well, a lot more?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that had the war not occurred, I don't know exactly what would have happened in 1939, because the colonial government was beginning to backtrack about how to put together this central federal assembly. They were sort of very concerned. They were very concerned about what Congress could do. The princes were concerned. The Muslim League was very concerned. And so it sounds sort of odd to say that the Second World War solved a problem, but it certainly allowed for a diversion of attention away from what was becoming a very difficult political situation, which was, you know, when do you actually begin to implement the next step? And the war served to basically freeze the 1935 Act in place. And of course, the circumstances of the war and the immediate aftermath of the war made it, you know, a template, made the 1935 Act, you know, sort of something to be consulted for future constitutions, but not necessarily something that was now operable in a post-war world.
I think that actually needs some more research on it. But in the meantime, thank you for doing this for the New Books Network, and it was a pleasure having you with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no problem at all.
So, Fox, a lovely podcast about the last major piece of legislation in British India and the people who were most deeply involved with it. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.